Hello and welcome to the Agile Revolution Podcast, episode number 3. I'm Renee Troughton, and today with me I have the lovely Tony Ponton.
We are missing one individual today.
We're missing a revolutionist.
Revolutionist. Yes, I'd call it that. We're missing one Craig CDAU 43 Smith. Renee, what have we got rock and rolling today on the Agile Revolution?
Well, normally we start with the wrap-up. Recent blogs that have been of interest to ourselves. What about yourself? Has there been anything interesting lately that you've had a look at?
I've been running around and having a look at a few things this week, and one that really piqued my interest was Kanban works better than Scrum, at least for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nifty little blog by Kuba, I think it was, org, which was quite good. And you know, this was their basic gist. They had some really long running tasks in computer vision engineering. And it doesn't make them sense to break down. They tried it, you know, and they weren't really sure how they were going with it. They have some specialists, computer vision and iPhone development. So they really were struggling on how they could break it down using this Scrum type methodology. So in reality, they decided to do a bit of time box certain tasks in sprints, and they ended up with water scrums, really.
Mm.
We've all been there. Whether it be Scrum or it be Agile, we've seen those ones happen. So what they did was they decided to attack it from a different way and approach it via the Kanban.
So does that mean they didn't actually break anything down?
It means that they tried to, but you've seen those projects, and I'm sure, you know, if Craig was here, he would have plenty of stories about it, as you do yourself, where you go in and they have tried to break them down, but they're not broken sufficiently. And I think one of my mentors, I love that little thing that he always said to me, is concentrate on making your stories small enough before worrying about estimating them.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
So that's the thing that I've always looked for. But again, it depends on the type of work that you're dealing with as well, isn't it? So one of the things that often there is a problem that we see is when they get this type of continuous work coming in and there's no control over the work in progress.
Yeah.
And that's very hard to handle in your, whether it be Scrum, XP, whatever it be. If you're not controlling your work in progress, controlling the sizing, if you're in an operational mode as opposed to a project mode, you often see problems.
And is that, in essence, what the blog's about, is that only through work in progress limiting did they find that they resolved their issues?
Yes, absolutely. With the limited work in progress concept, we attacked the problem at the source, was basically what they were saying. So it's a nifty little blog. I'll put it on the show notes so that someone can go and have a look at it. But it really piqued my interest in it. And, you know, there was nothing new in there, but what it just gave me was that, you know, there are people out there using this process as much as we are ourselves, and using it quite successfully.
Yeah, definitely.
Got one for me? What have you got?
Well, continuing on my theme of last week of actually not looking at Agile-related blogs, but looking at something else and how it could pertain to the Agile arena.
You revolutionist, you.
I was looking at a blog that was retweeted by Daniel Pink, and it probably was a news article more than anything else. It came directly from the New York Times. It was talking about, can a playground be too safe? Now, initially I had a look at it more probably because I have two kids and I was more curious about, well, how safe are playgrounds and what's the perception about how well they work from a childhood fear environment.
God, what happened to the old splinters, hot, slippery slides that burnt your bum, things that fell down, and the old monkey bars that crashed you?
Yeah, and this article was really talking about that, saying, you know, it's probably a sad thing that they've gone the way of the donkeys. It was talking about how playgrounds are ultimately there for challenge and mastery. And if you remember back to Daniel Pink's motivation work, mastery is one of those key motivators for us to continue to evolve as humans. But what I found particularly interesting about this article was that there is no direct correlation between how we've made playgrounds safer versus injuries that have occurred. So even though playgrounds are actually safer these days, so they're not as high, and there's these little bubbly padding at the floor of them, In essence, because people perceive them to be safer, they're taking greater risks.
So what you're saying to me is that team members will always find a way to break the process, no matter how safe we try to make it.
That's one of the learnings that we can take out of it.
I like it.
The other is around is the fact that you're less likely to be hurt. So you obviously, if you're going to be trying to take risks, and we talk about a safe to fail environment, right, within Agile, and safe to fail is the ability to fail. Now, what they've found is that children who are, you know, if they fall before the age of 9, they're less likely as a teenager to have a fear of heights. So it's really counterintuitive. We would have thought that people that fell would have been more scared of heights, but the reality of the situation is, if you fall more frequently, you're less likely to be afraid of heights. So going back to that safe to fail environment, unless you're continually failing, you're not going to be comfortable in the environment that you're in.
Again, it's that phrase, isn't it?
Hmm?
Success with failure.
Success with failure. What I think is quite curious about this, though, is that if you think about children growing up right now and how they're the programmers of the future, they've been sort of mollycoddled in this environment where it's not safe, it's dangerous, this world is dangerous, and what we might end up seeing in the next 10 years are these programmers that come up that just aren't willing to take any risks.
So from a program manager's point of view, that's perfect, but in reality, for the success of your project, for the evolution of your software, that's not great.
Well, even from a commercial innovation perspective, really, we're not encouraging innovation because we're not taking these risks.
I like it. Is there anything else you want to tell me about that blog?
No, thought it was a great blog. Every parent should read it.
Excellent. So I've got one more for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always looking for, obviously being a coach, always looking for tips. So I ran across this really nice one by peoplemanagementanalyticalmind.com,
mm-hmm.
which was 12 tips to better coach.
Great.
Not all of it's new.
I think I might have read this one, actually.
But some of it I quite like. Yeah. So, he broke it down, or they broke it down, inner silence. So to be truly effective at listening to what others are saying, you've got to keep that little voice inside your head and listen to what people are saying. Stop all judgment. And it's very easy, whether you're being a coach or whether you're in the middle of it all, is to be judgmental. And sometimes you have to sit back and go, let's not be judgmental about it, because it'll sidetrack your ability to be relative.
Yep.
Stay focused. I think that's a pretty obvious one.
So that's about staying in the moment and making sure that you're there with them rather than
correct
mentally yep. wafting off somewhere else.
Exactly right, because our attention spans do tend to rocket off and we scribble on a piece of paper and forget where we are.
Mm-hmm.
But for us as coaches, when we're working in that, it's very important. So they talk about developing your focusing muscle.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure where that is.
It's in your little pinky.
Be present, be in the moment, right there and right then, which I think really goes with the focus, but it's really the point being is that you need to be there and you can't fade out.
Yep.
Don't aim for personal performance. So I think that one is, and I actually like that one. It's not about you.
Okay.
It's about them.
Them, right.
So remember, you're not telling the story, you're there to listen.
Yep.
So I think that's a very important one. Trust your intuition was the other one.
Okay.
Which I think sometimes you have those gut feels and you don't listen to them.
Yeah. Do you wonder whether those gut feels are coming across via emotional intelligence and your ability to read body language and the signals that those persons are conveying?
Absolutely, I really do. And I think sometimes we ignore them because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a fine balance though between taking notice of it and letting it override everything else. So sometimes you have to apply a cool level head to it as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Keep silence. I think that's an important one. Sometimes as coaches, you can be the person who's up there doing all the talking.
Yep.
I think it's very important that you actually be silent sometimes.
Try and be silent.
Try to be silent. Hang on. There you go. There was our silence for the day. Pay attention to the non-verbal.
So again, that's going back to that body language.
Exactly. Ties back. Yeah. Words are a great way to communicate. Non-verbal clues. We've all seen it. It's how you get that pulse check sometimes, you know. It's a real thermometer check of how a team's going. If you just walk in, look around and see what the body languages are doing. And I think the next piece actually flies off that is dig deep. It's much easier to stay at the rational level of discussion. You've got to get in and ask, you know, what are the person's fears? What are the intentions? What are the motivations? Ask those feeling-related questions. Don't stray away from them.
So is that really about going back down to root cause analysis, keeping asking why and...
Yeah, I think it's a bit deeper than that.
Those open-ended questions?
I think it's a bit deeper than that, yeah. Because you can do root cause analysis and you can ask the open-ended questions without getting into the dig deep.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what this was about, and Lisa Atkins talks about it quite often too, when you read her book, is that when you're working with teams, you need to dig deep into the emotional side of things as well. So it's about asking those feeling-related questions that sometimes you stray away from.
Yep.
You might open a bucket sometimes, but sometimes I think that actually you get more out of it.
Mm.
Rephrasing.
Is this like paraphrasing?
Yeah, it's the old rephrasing, paraphrasing. So I'm not going to go into it. I think everybody's done that one to death. No context. Do not focus too much on the context. It's good to understand what triggered the action. So there's a bit of root cause analysis in that. So sometimes you look at the context of a conversation and people are flying off the handle.
Yeah. So is this about sidelining the emotion and putting in the logic? Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's also, I think it's also about saying to yourself, yes, I can see that they're going off about that situation, but is that actually where the context of this particular disagreement's coming from? And sometimes it's sort of drawing back. So I can draw it back to my own analogy of working with a very difficult team and an individual that was in that team. When it all came down to it, all of the objections and disagreements that were happening in a particular session had nothing to do with that session. They had to do with the fear of the way that we were moving as a team.
Yeah. So that's very interesting. I mean, a lot of the bullet points that you read out there were really related towards effective listening more than anything else. So the rephrasing, the paraphrasing, the digging deep and so forth, those are probably the only times that you actually would have talked if you were doing a coaching session.
I think, and I say this quite regularly, as a coach, and for people who are looking about being a coach, if someone comes to me and says to me, what's the thing about being a coach that differentiates you from being a trainer or being a team leader, you are the person that asks why.
Yep.
Don't get stuck in the doing.
Yep.
Be the person that is actually involved in the showing and the helping. Because for me, one mistake a lot of coaches make is they get their hands dirty.
Well, this is this clear distinction between what is a coach versus what is a consultant, really. And a lot of people have this misunderstanding that a coach does delve into the deeps or does give advice. Now, a coach, at its essence, and we're talking about a pure coach, doesn't give any solicited advice.
Correct.
They're there to help the team reach their own level of understanding and their own solutions without providing any help. So there's this really thin line between coaching versus consulting that as an agile coach you go through in the day-to-day. So a lot of elements that you're doing is you're either choosing to be a coach and literally helping the team reach their own solutions, or you are doing that consulting advice. So that article really doesn't talk about the difference between those two.
No, definitely.
But it is something to be very conscious of. There is a distinction between those two.
Absolutely. And I think if you've listened to the Gene Tabakas or you've listened to the Lisa Atkins or even the Alistair Coburns, they talk about don't be the problem solver for the team.
Yeah.
It's very easy as the coach to be the person that falls into the problem solving. The whole idea of having that team there is that they as the team need to make the decisions. What you do is help them work on the ways of working together to make those decisions as a group.
So sometimes the difficulty lies in the fact that the team isn't aware of what alternate solutions are out there. So you need to give that advice. But the actual ultimate choosing of the solution and the direction that they go down is theirs.
And there's nothing better as a coach when it gets to the point where they don't need you.
Yep.
For me, that's you know, job done. However, I know that there is a perception both within teams and in the wider world where they expect you to get down and be the one that does everything. Now, I have no problems getting in and helping a team and showing them how to do things, but you need a succession plan as well.
Yeah.
And I've talked about that with you before, is that if you're in the doing, then you can't be a coach. You're not a good coach.
You're then a team member if you're in the doing.
That's exactly right. All right, Renee, have we done that one to death?
Excellent. Let's move on to the thought of the day.
Thought of the day.
It's from Alistair Coburn's Oath of Non-Allegiance.
Viva la revolution, baby!
I don't know if you've read the pretext associated with the particular Oath of Non-Allegiance, but it talks about this is a quote from Alistair, "I'm tired of people from one school of thought dissing ideas from another school of thought. I hunger for people who don't care where the ideas come from, just what they mean and what they produce." So this is the pretext associated with the Oath of Non-Allegiance. And then the actual oath itself. "I promise not to exclude from consideration any idea based upon its source, but to consider ideas across schools and heritages in order to find the ones that best suit the current situation."
I couldn't have said it any better. And you know that I'm an unadulterated Alistair Coburn fan, and if you're listening, Alistair, you
fan
know
that as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm a fanboy. And I've been lucky to spend some considerable time with Alistair recently, as you're aware. And we spoke on this. And I'm so for this approach because, for me, if you're out there painting that Agile is the panacea, that it has no gaps, that it's the unadulterated cure to everything, then we're no better or no worse than any of the other types of frameworks, methodologies that have become so indoctrined. Step outside the dogma and say, yes, there are situations where we have gaps or we need to look at something else that will fill that we can actually bring in.
Yeah, I love this quote. I'm just, when I read it, my heart just skipped a beat. It just felt so right. Now, the reason why I felt so passionate about it is that I've seen a number of the thought leaders who were involved in the creation of the Agile Manifesto. So, you know, a whole group of guys got together in a jacuzzi in Salt Lake City 10 years ago.
A jacuzzi.
Well, obviously it was a jacuzzi. They were having fun, weren't they?
Yeah. No, I don't think that's how it went down, but we'll go with it anyway.
Well, I like to think of them all together in a jacuzzi having fun in Salt Lake City, because surely it would have been cold there.
Well, it was cold.
But at the end of the day, when they were together, they found it really hard to get a common set of elements together to call what these frameworks and what these methodologies or approaches were. And they came out with the Agile Manifesto. And the reason, and it was four simple lines. That was the only thing that they could agree on between themselves. So there's quite a lot of, you know, my stuff versus their stuff going on in order for them just to get to those four sentences. So there was a lot of disagreements, a lot of dissension between ideas of themselves. And what you see today are people who are picking up Agile who are understanding the differences between each of those approaches and applying it in a contextual sense of what is appropriate for that particular problem. Now, where this is interesting is that these guys, a number of them that were in that jacuzzi, just haven't moved on mentally with what Alistair's saying. I've seen a number of these thought leaders who are just continually stagnant that theirs is the only way, and not really looking at any of the other agilists or looking outside of their box to see what is working that they could potentially evolve.
Okay, so the question I ask about that is because, I guess, does it become, that reason is because it becomes more about making money than it becomes about actually
I suspect it is. There's some of those elements. I know that, for example, Kanban was received as a very strong threat for a number of them, and their attitudes towards that reflect that threat, probably from a financial element more than anything else. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're not them. We can't think inside their head, and we don't really know where they're perceiving threats to be or why they're not adopting these things. But there are leaders such as Alistair who's trying to say, look around you. It's not just Agile. There are other things that we can learn from. Now, what I find also interesting is that, you know, we can look out of the box of Agile and say, well, what else can we learn from? There's two elements that I think of when I think about that particular approach. One is that when we're picking up things outside of Agile, there's nothing wrong with us bringing it into the fold of Agile. So, you know, I always think of Agile as an umbrella term, and I like to think of it as something that will continue to grow and evolve as the years go on. And as we learn and blend in these different approaches, they're just different things that you can use in your toolkit.
I absolutely agree with you. Although, umbrella always feels uncomfortable for me. I struggle with the right word. You know, I hear framework and I hear umbrella.
Mm.
So for me, the one I've been throwing at is it's more an ethos.
Okay.
Leave that with you as a thought. But for me, the connotation of an ethos is it covers that whole capability to bring things in rather than just the umbrella or the framework. Anyway, that's just my thoughts on it.
The other thing that I think of when I think about this particular quote is the risk of the new shiny.
Let's chase the shiny.
Yes, so there's this thought of this other thing out there that is better than what we have, and totally forgetting the things that are working and moving on with this new idea, and not necessarily going, hey, we were doing this fairly good. We didn't really need to change this. And I believe that Alistair's trying to address by saying, you know, trying to find the ones that best suit the current situation, and that you're not necessarily going to always focus on the new shiny. A clear example of this is around retrospectives. So for quite a while, we've been doing retrospectives as a group, and there's a number of different frameworks towards doing that. There's a whole book dedicated towards doing it.
There's a million gazillion.
There's all these different ideas. The question that a lot of people have is that, well, should we try doing something new each retrospective? And I think for me, it goes back to this element of mastery. If you've mastered retrospectives and if they're getting boring for you, then go do it differently. But until you've reached that point, until you've actually mastered it and you've got as much value out of that framework, then wouldn't necessarily go towards chasing the new shiny on that.
And I think that goes with everything, right? You have to be very careful that you're not trying to change it just for the sake of changing it. Now, one of the things that you often hear a number of people talk about is the shuhara in the re, right? And so you often see teams that get to that phase in the re where they start to reinvent and change things.
Yep.
And they break it.
Yep.
And so that's often where we as coaches get called in.
Yep.
To help readdress. And a retro is a very good example. You often come into the retros and you look at it and go, well, is it broken? Well, essentially it's not broken. It's broken by the way that you're trying to attempt it. You've tried to change the way that you're doing it and it hasn't worked for the team. So yep. Sometimes it's better to go, let's keep it simple, let's get back to where we started. The biggest thing out of continuous improvement and retrospective is make sure that what you're coming out with is a clear, definable action.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind, how you do it.
Well, not only that, but it's also actions. Something that does get actioned as well.
You got something else for us?
No, that's all I had on that particular quote. Do you have any thoughts on it?
I think I've said my bit on it. I mean, I'm a very clear advocate of that particular quote. Linked back on my website to it. You can.
Have you signed up?
What? Yes.
So for the listeners out there, you can go onto Alistair Coburn's site and sign up to this.
Absolutely. You'll find my name on there. In fact, I signed up last year sometime.
Excellent.
So, and you can also then, if you so wish and you feel very passionate about it, Alistair's opened that up, you can take the icon, you can link back to it from your website, no charges.
Excellent. So moving on to feature time.
Feature time.
We're going to be talking about facepalm moments in coaching.
OMG!
Should do it again, ready? One, two, three.
Not sure if that's going to work sound-wise, but visually, we both now have red marks on our foreheads. Anyway, shall we continue?
So facepalm moments are really those pieces of time when you're coaching and you just think, oh, God, I can't believe they said that. And you can't actually put your hand up to your head in a very commercial sense. You have to, you know, put your poker face on, smile and nod and just think, oh my goodness, behind the scenes. So what are your facepalm moments?
So here's my favourite one. This is not going to work for me. My technology is different.
I'm different. I'm a snowflake.
Sheldon. Yes. For me, that one, if I had a dollar for every time I've heard it, and to be honest with you, every team and every person that actually says it, actually believes it, actually has these reasons that they want to validify to say, we're different.
And so how do you approach that?
After I facepalm myself several times and then got my breath back, what I often draw them back to start with is to say, why is your technology different? So explain to me how it's considerably different when you have other massive companies out there, such as the Googles and the Nokias and all these other different companies employing Agile, employing it successfully, And I also, depending on what the technology is, I may draw them back to other experiences that I've had.
So step one, listen.
Yep.
Step two, relate it back to where their mm-hmm. particular problem has been previously resolved by other groups and give them that scenario.
Be very careful about tackling it head on.
Yep.
Because it becomes very confrontational. Confronting. Yeah. So there's a couple of ways that you can tackle it. There's obviously that way that I've said there, or sometimes with those particular moments, it's really about, okay, I understand where you're at, give me some time, give us some space, and let's try it at least. And the proof with those particular individuals is usually about the showing and seeing.
Yeah, and it's about little wins, really. It's not about a mammoth win, it's about little bits and actually providing that success back to them, going, well, how did that feel? How did that work? And giving that reflection and then going, okay, let's take the next step on this.
Correct. What about yourself?
I've had plenty of facepalm moments.
I'm sure you have.
Probably the biggest of my facepalm moments are around project managers that just don't get agile. They've had a very strong background in the area of waterfall or planned-driven approaches. And there's a couple of elements in particular around those types of PMs that really make me want to facepalm. One is around daily stand-ups. And you see some incredibly dysfunctional stand-ups whereby...
Shouldn't the project manager control it?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
So you have these people round in a circle and the project manager actually literally stands at the story wall and then turns to the first person in the circle, points their hand to them and goes, right, what did you do yesterday?
Yes, lovely. That really helps collaboration.
And he doesn't refer back to the board at all. The people don't refer back to the board. And it just goes one by one by each individual and what they did yesterday, what they plan on doing today, because that's apparently what a stand-up's meant to be about.
Right.
The other one that I've seen a couple of times, which it really is a very strong facepalm for me, is you go to the effort of breaking down all this work into stories. You understand roughly where these stories are going to sit from iteration to iteration and what your plan velocity is. And then what you find inevitably after having those high level workshops with the team is that a couple of days later, the project manager will come back to you and go, here, I've done it as a Gantt chart and they've input every single story into Microsoft Project. And they've put it into the different iterations inside of there. I'm going, that's really great. But that's not what we're going to be doing. And they've already gone up to the steering committee, presented this beautiful Microsoft Gantt chart to them, sort of, you're not getting it.
So for all project managers that are listening to this and looking to move towards the Agile ethos, let me tell you something that I thought was really great at Agile Australia, and I believe it was Nigel Dalton who said, every time a Gantt chart is created, a fairy dies. I can't put it any plainer than that.
There's been a couple of other ones that have got me as facepalm moments. One is around, I had a project demonstrating to some senior executives what Agile was and doing an actual process improvement project by using Agile. Now, this is their first introduction to Agile, so they've never seen it before. So they was doing Agile by introducing Agile. And I organized for all of them to get into a room together to do the initial workshops about, you know, strategic planning about where we wanted to go, how we wanted to get there, breaking it down from a visionary perspective about where we wanted to go and the objectives associated with it. And I was told by one of the people, this was whilst I was actually in the room for the first ever workshop, one of the executives turned up early and goes, this should be interesting, which immediately triggered some thoughts of nervousness.
The alarm bells, yeah.
And asked why, and they said, well, we've never been in the room together.
Oh, there's a facepalm moment.
So this group of senior executives, who are all peers of each other, you know, reporting to the CIO, had never, ever been in a room together. And I just thought, well, if any place needs Agile, this certainly is a place for it. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, what was brilliant out of it is despite, you know, how we progressed down the Agile path, at least from there on, they regularly met each other and talked about the problems. And it really did create a bond and a communication path that never existed before.
So I think my other facepalm one is, and it's one that pops up regularly when you're estimating. and you've gone through the process of, you know, working with the team about relative estimation, and you're using the story points, and you banned the term hours, minutes, days, just so that they get used to the relative. And then your PM or your sponsor or whoever it may be goes, that's good. How many hours is that? What does that equal in dollars? Gotta love it.
Yep. Again, back to that really traditional PM mentality.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, there's some interesting struggles with that stuff. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting one, because in a commercial world, if we talk about benefits realization and cost to a particular project, do you think it's unfair that senior managers want to know that figure? That they want to know that given these particular benefits, we think it's going to cost this much?
I think there are ways of giving them back those costs relatively.
Without relating it to the stories.
Absolutely correct.
Right.
So that's my opinion of it, and I think that's why we do what we do.
Yep.
Let's face it, you don't want to spend... So my answer to that, when I talk to executives and project managers and so on, I say to them, how many estimates have you received in the past?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, so you've got an estimate for that project that was done, Gantt charted, it was estimated down to the nth degree, it had plus or minus 50%, it had plus or minus 50% tolerance. Okay, so it was accurate. Plus or minus 50%. My other answer to that is, how many of those projects have ever actually come in on budget and on time that was estimated?
Or even if they did come in on budget and time, did it actually meet the end user's needs? And I think that's more important.
Well, that's another point too. But I got to tell you, there's very few of them actually come in on time.
I've seen plenty that have come in on time and on budget. Just
really,
no one ever wants to use the resulting system.
All right. So what's happened there is there's been some interesting scope changes and things that have happened.
Basically, okay. Scope has been continually cut back to whatever could be delivered on time and on budget.
I'll give you that one. Hands in the air. Paws in the air. No arguments.
COTS really is a bit of a bugbear for me, so commercial off-the-shelf software done in an agile way, and yet when you look at the implementation associated with it, pretty much there's a lot of customization. So in a commercial off-the-shelf product, you've got these two elements. One is customization versus configuration, all right? So when you configure a product, we're talking about some sort of GUI that will enable you to change how you're implementing that particular product. When we're talking about customization, we're talking about the person who owns that software, being the vendor, physically changing code in it in order for you to use the system. In an ideal world, when you're using COTS, you want to always go towards configuration rather than customization. The reason behind that is as soon as you start customizing, when the vendor releases a new version for that in the future, they're gonna have to re-implement all that code.
Absolutely.
Again and again. So there's a huge cost towards customization. Yeah. Every single time that you choose it, you're asking for it to be added several times through the life of the product.
Yet as an industry, we continue to do it. And yeah, as an industry, we continue to sustain that cost. So what I see that is a very short-term cost view.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, so the cost saving, oh, this is going to cost us less because blah, 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 blah. But if you do more than, say, 10% customization, all of a sudden you're into a world of hurt you no longer can implement. And I've seen that happen many times.
So my big facepalm is anytime I hear the word customization and COTS together in a sentence, it just makes me cringe very greatly. So if anyone's listening out there and you're implementing a COTS-based system, configure it. Don't customize it. And by all means, keeping in mind, you're buying the software product the way it is, and you have your own business processes out there. What you must do if you're going towards a COTS-based solution is change your processes to meet the product, not the other way around. You don't change the product to meet your processes. And that's a huge failure point that a lot of people make when they're implementing COTS solutions.
So I've got a couple more left, but won't want to do it over death, but I guess one of the ones that when introducing to teams, pair programming.
Mm.
Yeah, and part of that, you usually try to introduce test-driven development, or I try to.
Yep.
And I think the last time I heard this was very interesting. We were introducing the test-driven development piece, and a particular individual stood up and said, "We're not doing that. We're all adults here, and we've been testing our own code for the last 20 years. Why would we write the test first?"
And what's your answer to that particular conundrum?
Well, actually, in that particular instance, I was lucky it was a very functional team,
yep.
Very self-organising team. Well, I have had to, and they dealt with it for me. However, in that instance, what I have said to the individuals at the time is, if that's the case, then I want you to explain to me why I have all those bugs.
Yeah.
So let's have a look at it. Let's go your way. Let's have a look at the amount of bugs that we get. Then let's flip it on its head and try it the other way and see if we get a reduction in the bugs.
I think I like about test-driven development is that it gives you that element of success really quite quickly. So, I mean, the moment you start writing a test, before you've even written the code, you've got a failure point, you've got something that's wrong there. And as soon as you start writing the code, you start getting wins at the board, you start getting these lights turn from red to green. I think that's a really great positive result of test-driven development.
Yeah, and I've just been working with a team just recently. You know, we introduced a small framework around that, which is, you know, basically saying to the testers, you know, you must have this conversation with your developer and the SME and your business analyst before you even attempt to do anything with it. So we make them sit down around a table and talk about how they're going to test it,
yeah.
Both them and the developers. And they were very hesitant to do that. But basically what I did with that instance is it then used this little stampy thing, you know, and gave the testers a stamp and said, when you finish that conversation, put a stamp on it, right?
Yeah.
Now, one of the things with that is it makes them have that conversation about how they're going to test it. And all of a sudden, you do see a reduction of bugs. And just recently, that particular team sent me a message back saying, bugs have reduced amazing, or defects have reduced amazingly, has more confidence in it. They're moving through their iterations much quicker. It's just proof in the pudding.
Yeah.
Anything else from you?
No. Craig?
Craig? There we are. We left a space for him to have his say. It was a fun knowledge.
Tool talk. Ready?
Oh, tool talk. It's tool time.
Today's tool is Lean Kit.
Lean Kit. So I have to stop. One moment, I did make the promise last week that I would jump on Linuit because I hadn't used it, and I actually have it sitting on my iPad.
And
I quite like it, I do. I actually did, though, come across some of the problems that you had on the iPad version.
Yeah.
So for me, that was a little disappointing, but I did try it on the PC-based version.
Yeah, PC one's better.
Yeah, and then I did, I came across, it was very funny, but I actually went to a distributed retrospective.
Yep.
With we had some people in Scotland.
Wow. Oh, okay.
And here, and they were using Ideas Board.
Ideas Board.
So there's another one for you. That worked very well.
Mhm.
So just throw it out there for you.
Right. But Lean Kit.
So let's pop back to Lean Kit. Pop back to Lean Kit.
Have you heard of play with Lean Kit?
Well, I have played with Lean Kit, and I didn't have any choice. You made me. So in developing this podcast, there are a lot of things that we had to do.
Which we did as a Kanban-based board.
Correct. We had to eat our own dog food, drink our own Kool-Aid.
Yes. Now, I mean, the reason why I chose Lean Kit for the creation of the podcast itself was a lot of the tools that were out there, the free tools, were limited to the number of users of two or less.
And we
had three people. It meant that we really couldn't use a lot of the tools that were out there. So I had a look at Lean Kit primarily because it has a free one board for up to five people.
Right. And elucidate, whilst we ruminate, how did you feel it worked?
It was certainly very easy to use out of the box, very user-friendly. I've also recently downloaded the iPad app for it.
Ooh.
The iPad app, I'd actually say, is superior to the online version. Not dramatically, but I found it a bit more user-friendly than the online version.
Lovely.
Things that I like about it, there's obviously you can pay for a more unrestricted version of it. So you can pay for a team edition, which is $10 per user per month. Or you can pay for a professional version, which is $15 per user per month. And they each give extra added bonuses. You know, when you get up to the professional layer, you've got SSL, you've got more charts, you've got multi-user being able to be assigned and so forth. And both of those paid for versions give you free board viewers, so people who can't necessarily change the board but can
see the board.
See the board.
Okay.
Now, what I do like about it is that it's very dynamic from a flow perspective, so choosing what your flows are, renaming them, and having multiple flows at the same time, so it's quite powerful in that area of Kanban. You can specify your work in progress limits. You can do email, RSS notifications.
As I noticed.
Yeah. it does have diagrams as well, such as your standard cumulative flow diagram.
Yes, I saw those, yeah.
Lead time. I never actually saw them. I couldn't find how to get to them, but that might have been just me. I saw pictures of them on the ads, but I know that they do exist. You can create custom cards. Again, I didn't see how you can do that. The thing that I probably didn't like the most about it was really a very nitpicky thing, and that was more the colour scheme. I found it just a bit garish for me.
Okay.
And the other thing I really didn't like about it was the way that it handled the backlog. And I'm still in two minds about whether I like it or not. So it treated the backlog as a separate screen, and getting the backlog and the main flow into the same screen at the same time wasn't that easy. It was easier on the iPad than it was on the actual internet-based system. I don't know whether I would separate the backlog as something that you see, as a toggle, see, don't see. And I couldn't really find a way to resize the frames for the backlog, so how big the backlog was in context to the other flow elements. But for the most part, you know, if I was going to rate it out of 5, I would give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Wow, 4.5 out of 5 stars. Yeah, and I concur, it's very intuitive. Mm. I didn't have a problem using it. Notifications, whenever Renee created a card quite regularly, I got lots of notifications quite regularly. overdue notifications, you haven't done what you're supposed to do quite regularly. However, I thought it was good. I haven't tried the iPad version, I will do so. However, I would concur with your rating.
Yep.
What I would say out there again, we'll say this every week, is that any of the tools that we assess, we are not being paid to assess those tools. They are merely our opinion.
Yep. Our very time-limited opinion.
That's too. Right. And again, if you feel like passing some money along, no, seriously. Not that we're cash-strapped or anything, if you know.
There was an interesting couple of points about how they're changing the work in progress limits. They're actually allowing you to limit work in progress by the number of story points assigned to a particular individual. So they're recognising that this might be used by users other than Kanban-based users, such as Scrum users. So it's trying to broaden its own community out to others in Agile other than Kanban.
They've obviously signed the Oath of Non-Allegiance.
They have.
So we need to move on. We're running close to time.
Yep.
So I think that brings us to the last of our segments that we're trying to do, and that's our problem bag.
Yep.
Fire away with a problem.
Sure.
What have you got for us this week?
So what we have is one question around, should non-business work, i.e. IT setup related work, be considered stories?
Your opinion?
I definitely believe so, yes.
And should it be estimated is the other part of the question for me.
Definitely, yes.
So my answer to that is I agree. Why, Renee?
At the end of the day, what you're going to be delivering is everything. Even though there's limited business value in it, I think the challenge is that you need to articulate the value and you need to make the business aware of what the value is in those IT stories. You cannot possibly deliver the business value until these IT stories are done. And if you're talking about the end-to-end time to deliver the project, you have to include it in. And if you don't track it like the same way as you track everything else, then you've got these two different schemes of tracking, and it just doesn't make sense to me.
I absolutely agree. So my take on it is that the very essence of writing a story should be done with the group, whether it be IT or a business value.
Yep.
And 9 times out of 10, there is an inherent business value in the IT-based piece of work.
Yep.
And that sharing of what it does, how it does it, and how it's delivering the business value comes through doing that.
Yep.
The second thing for me, I often walk in on projects where they have IT-based cards and they don't estimate them.
Mm.
If it's worth doing, it's worth estimating.
Yeah.
Because somebody's spending time on it.
Just to give an example, I mean, these sort of IT stories that we're talking about, this IT work is, for example, a version control system for your source code. Business value? Questionable. But reality, when you think about it, if you didn't have this source repository and your PC died or the server died, it doesn't really matter too much. But the point is, the value of that as an element is around risk mitigation.
So there you are. You're delivering business value.
Exactly.
So, great. Well, I think that's us done.
Fantastic. So I'd like to thank Tony for being here.
I'd like to thank me for being here. And I'd like to thank you for being here. I'd like to thank Craig for...
Sort of being here. I'd like to thank Chill Carrier for the music. And if you have any questions for us, you can email them to podcast@theagilerevolution.com. Alternatively, you can email me at Renee, R-E-N-E-E, at theagilerevolution.com, or...
Tony@theagilerevolution.com, or Craig...
At theagilerevolution.com. And check our website out at theagilerevolution.com.
Theagilerevolution.com. Well, I guess till next week.
Till next week. Viva la revolution.
Join us, brothers and sisters.